Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, July 3rd. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. Well, first let's have a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today in the Cedar Rapids, Iowa City area, it'll be mostly sunny, the wind from the southwest at 9 miles per hour. We'll have a high of 87 and a low of 65. Tomorrow, Sunday, it will be mostly sunny, a high of 89 and a low of 63. On Monday, partly cloudy, a high of 90 and a low of 71. On Tuesday, there's a chance of storms, a high of 89 and a low of 67. The normal high for this day is 85, the normal low, 64. The record high was 105 in 1911. The record low was 43 in 1924. The sun will set tonight at 8:46. It will rise tomorrow at 5:37. We have a little weather story today, this one from meteorologist Kaylee Plutchel. Drought conditions improve slightly. With the latest drought monitor update, conditions have slightly improved across the state and in eastern Iowa. Currently, 85% of the state is under some sort of drought conditions, but that is an improvement from 92% last week. Severe drought conditions also decreased by almost 8%. Portions of Howard, Chickasaw, Winnesheik, Fayette, Bremer, Butler, Grundy, Marshall, and Floyd counties are still under those severe drought conditions. Moderate drought extends southeast from that point to the Dubuque, Linn, and Iowa counties, with pretty much the entire southeastern corner of the state under no sort of drought condition. And again, that little weather story is from meteorologist Kaylee Plutchel. Now let's turn to our first story of the day from the front page of today's Gazette. We have this story under the headline, Cedar Rapids Gun Violence Drops 22% So Far in 2021, but 5 people have been fatally shot since January. And the story is by Kat Russell of the Gazette. While gun violence has skyrocketed across the nation, the number of shootings in Cedar Rapids reported in the first half of 2021 is down roughly 22% compared with the same time period the year before. According to data from the Cedar Rapids Police Department, there have been 60 verified shots fired incidents so far in 2021, from January 1st to June 30th. During that same period in 2020, the city saw 77 incidents. The decline comes on the heels of one of the city's most violent years, with a record high 163 shots fired incidents in 2020. There were 12 homicides, 10 due to gun violence, representing the highest number of killings recorded in a 12-month period in at least 60 years in the city. One of this year's 60 verified incidents so far, of this year's 60 verified incidents so far, 3 resulted in the deaths of 5 people and 7 resulted in the injuries of 8 people. Another 28 incidents resulted in property damage. Public safety spokesperson Greg Bulow said verified shots fired incidents are those in which a person was injured or killed, property was damaged, shell casings were found, or that surveillance video or multiple witnesses corroborate. The numbers do not include suicides or accidental gun discharges, he said. February recorded 2 shots fired incidents, the lowest number of incidents recorded in any month since April 2016, when 3 incidents were recorded, and the lowest number recorded during the month of February since 2019, when 4 incidents were reported. May recorded the highest number of incidents with 15 shots fired reports. January and June were close behind with 13 incidents each. 10 incidents were reported in March and 7 in April. Bulow said 3 of the January incidents can be traced to a single suspect, David S. Schneider, 41, of Cedar Rapids. Police said Schneider was suspected in 3 incidents, one on January 8th and 2 on January 13th. Iowa court records show he was charged with just 1 count of discharging a firearm. A criminal complaint states he recklessly and needlessly discharged a handgun into the air. Police said no injuries or property damage were reported. The other 2 incidents did not result in charges. Bulow said there were several incidents in the past 6 months where firearms were discharged into the air or the ground as a warning shot to either intimidate or break up a fight. Warning shots are illegal and particularly dangerous, he said, as they easily could result in unintended injury or death. The data shows that at least 10 of the year's incidents stemmed from or involved some sort of altercation. Additionally, six incidents were identified as having occurred in or near a bar, or the shots were fired at a bar. In 9 of the incidents listed in the data, arrests have been made or suspects have been identified. In 6 incidents, the data shows police received no cooperation from victims. 3 of the year's shootings have resulted in deaths of 5 people. Most recently, husband Jan Perry Jackson, 61, his wife Melissa Fern Jackson, 68, and their daughter Sabrina Hannah Jackson, 19, were shot to death June 15th in their home at 4414 Oak Leaf Court Northeast. The couple's son, Alexander Jackson, 20, faces 3 counts of first-degree murder in the killing of his family. 2 additional people have died by gunfire so far this year. Jason Jones, 21, was shot January 3rd at a home at 818 11th Avenue Southeast. Jones was taken by car to the hospital about 2:16 a.m. and pronounced dead a short time later. No arrests have been made. His death marked the city's first homicide of 2021. Davion Flemings, 26, was found shot to death in the driveway of a home in the 1600 block of 32nd Street Northeast. The shooting occurred just after 9:30 p.m., April 15th. No arrests have been made. In addition to the deaths, 7 of seven of the year's shootings resulted in 8 people being injured. Police have not released any details about the victims, other than some basic demographic information. 5 of the injured people are black men, according to the data, and 2 are black women. 1 is a white man. Of those, Bulow said, 2 are juveniles and 3 are between 15 and 24. The remaining 3 are adults. Cedar Rapids Police Chief Wayne German said the department is continuing to use a number of programs and assets, including the Police Community Action Team, as well as grant-funded programs that include a violence reduction initiative in efforts to curb the violence. Additionally, German said the department is tapping partnerships with local, state, and federal resources, including the FBI Streets Task Force and the Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, and working with federal prosecutors to hold those responsible for gun violence accountable. The Cedar Rapids Department acquired a NIBIN, N-I-B-I-N system in September 2020 that allows for the capture and comparison of ballistic evidence from shell casings to match to firearms, which should aid in solving and preventing violent crimes. Chief German said, Cedar Rapids is not the only city dealing with gun violence. The Washington Post said gunfire killed more than 8,100 people in the United States between January 1st and May 31st this year. Quote, one shooting or one death is one too many, German said in a statement. It is more important than ever for community involvement to cooperate with law enforcement and collectively work to eliminate violence in our city. All right, let's see what else we have here. Well, from the Iowa Today page, we have this story, Ways to Entertain Your Kids During the Summer. Cedar Rapids Parks Programs offer animals, arts, crafts, sports. And this story is by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette. At the Duck Pond Pavilion in Beaver Park, a group of kids watched as Chuck Ungs, I guess that's the way it's pronounced, a naturalist from Linn County Conservation. Let me begin that sentence again. At the Duck Pond Pavilion in Beaver Park, a group of kids watched as Chuck Ungs, a naturalist from Linn County Conservation, displayed animal hides and talked about the animals who donated those hides. Later, the kids were able to handle turtles and a snake and learn about them. The program was part of the Fuzzy, Furry, Slimy, Scaly activity, one of many programs the Cedar Rapids Parks and Recreation Department is offering kids and adults this summer. Interest in the activities has exploded this year, after most of the programs were canceled last year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Angie Cole, the city's recreation superintendent. Many of the activities filled up quickly, and even though the department added sections for the more popular activities, waiting lists still exist for youth sports leagues and the day camp. Cole said, quote, Cedar Rapids is opening back up, and with that, people are ready to get out and play. Beaver Park Sports, Old McDonald's Farm, a perennial favorite, where kids can see and or pet chickens, goats, pigs, and other farm animals. The department also offers arts programs in painting, sculpting, and mixed media classes for kids from 5 to 11 years at the Northwest Recreation Center at 1340 11th Street Northwest. Cole said, quote, we have everything from kids' art programs that are just getting dirty and making crafts to watercolor classes for adults. We have quite a few adults that take those watercolor classes that really enjoy just the peacefulness and learning and painting together. Face masks are not required to attend the programs, though they are encouraged for unvaccinated people, which includes children under 12 who aren't eligible for the vaccine. The city's sports leagues for youth and adults include ones for softball, t-ball, basketball, soccer, and volleyball. Also, a kids' day camp runs Monday through Friday through the first week of August, with a different theme each week. Themes in July include All-American, Games Galore, and Beach Party. Cole said the department chooses which activities to offer by evaluating the success of past ones and also by considering the popular hobbies of the time. For example, some people stuck inside during the pandemic took up gardening, and canning, so the city decided to offer classes for those activities. She said, quote, "If you're going to live in our community, you want something for your family to do together. You want to be able to connect to other people in your community. Information about the programs and activities is on the Parks and Recreation website and can be found by calling 319-286-5566. Last summer, the city dreamed up the Roland Recmobile to take games and activities to city parks. It's back this year with stops in 13 parks each week this summer, and with more activities, including spike ball, kickball, gaga ball, an obstacle course, a bounce house, and karaoke. The Recmobile has a free Wi-Fi hotspot, as does the Cedar Rapids Public Library mobile technology van, which goes along to four of the parks. The library van also offers laptops, e-readers, and Ozobots, tiny robots that help kids learn coding. At Old McDonald's Farm, kids from ages 3 to 7 can visit on Tuesday mornings in July to learn about the farm animals with activities relating to the animals. On most Thursdays in July, kids age 6 to 10 can be a, quote, farmer for a day and learn how to care for the animals and perform farm chores. The farm's director, Megan LaPata, said the activities sell out each year. The best part of her job, she says, is teaching children things that they don't know and then seeing the smiles of the kids' faces when they come in. It's a nice story. All right, let's see what else we have here. Here's, I'm going to turn to the inside page of the Gazette and read some of the stories here. First, we have a guest column by Mary Hogg, who lives in Cedar Rapids. This column appears under the headline, "Really, Cedar Rapids?" "I'm writing as a very concerned citizen of Cedar Rapids, and out of concern for one particular direction the city of Cedar Rapids seems to be taking. This direction is the decision by the City Council and Cargill to build a rail yard operating 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, in the Rompott neighborhood on the southeast side of our city. Construction has begun on this rail yard, sadly sacrificing a beautiful 27-acre prairie pollinator zone. On this pollinator zone are monarch butterflies, among other species, who are needed to keep the environment plentiful and to keep the natural systems intact. According to the Science Museum of Minnesota website, quote, today the point of a prairie pollinator zone is how the prairie plays a part in the larger ecosystem. The prairie's role as habitat for a variety of other creatures is also key, especially the insects that pollinate our food. Destroying this beautiful prairie pollinator zone in Cedar Rapids means destroying a natural habitat for many species that are helpful to the environment. Ironically, the decision to destroy this land seems diametrically opposed to other action items Cedar Rapids has made in the past." Let me begin that again. "Ironically, the decision to destroy this land seems diametrically opposed to other action items Cedar Rapids has made in the past related to the environment. In fact, the city enjoys many parks and bike paths, and the Prairie Park fishery is near this site. Also, destroying this beautiful pollinator zone in Cedar Rapids means a change in the neighborhood for Rompott residents. The noise will increase, and the rail yard will potentially pollute the Cedar River. In addition, the potential exists for property values to decline when a rail yard moves into a neighborhood. Would you want a rail yard in your neighborhood? Additionally, the city of Cedar Rapids and Cargill seem hell-bent on moving forward with construction of the Cargill rail yard, even when Cargill already has a rail yard at nearly the exact distance away that the new rail yard will be. Further, this decision to move forward is occurring while the matter still is at the Iowa Supreme Court level, waiting to be heard. Really, Cedar Rapids? Is this decision really a wise one to make? I don't think so. And again, that guest column is by Mary Hogg, who lives in Cedar Rapids. And now we will turn to community letters. And today there's just one letter. This from Harry Phillips of Solon. Please, Governor, show us your humanity. I'm unable to understand why our governor so virulently opposes allowing unaccompanied refugee minors to set foot in our state. It can't be based on Judeo-Christian or Islamic beliefs, all of which teach us to welcome strangers into our midst and shelter them. The Gospel of Matthew teaches that in rejecting the stranger, in rejecting the stranger, we reject Christ. We're a nation of immigrants. It's central to our national creed. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Robert Ray and the first incarnation of Terry Branstad. Let me begin that again. Robert Ray and the first incarnation of Terry Branstad opened our state to refugees, leading the nation and provided them material support, willingly paid for by Iowa taxpayers, with the generous support of agencies such as Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services. It can't be for reasons of public safety. Study after study has shown that newly arrived immigrants account for the tiniest fraction of crimes compared to the general population. And it can't be for any pragmatic reasons. Our native-born population is in decline. So why does Governor Kim Reynolds want to shut the door to our state and send away the small number of refugee children? I'd like to be charitable and assume She's been blinded by her own political ambitions. I sincerely hope she comes around, guided by her faith, her Iowa values, her pragmatism, and her patriotism. And again, that letter is from Harry Phillips of Solon. And now I'll pause for a second, have another sip of coffee. And now, also from the insight page of the Gazette, we have this guest column by Norman Sherman, who is a resident of Coralville and who has worked in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary. From Social Security to Obamacare. From Franklin Roosevelt to Joe Biden. From Social Security to Medicare. Obamacare and beyond. Conservative opposition is predictable, repetitive, more about simple obstruction than seeking common ground. And when Roosevelt proposed in 1935, that we have a national retirement program, Social Security, the American Bar Association. Let me begin that again. When Roosevelt proposed in 1935 that we have a national retirement program, Social Security, the American Bar Association, the National Chamber of Commerce, the American Medical Association, and virtually all congressional conservatives seemed incapable of understanding what it would mean to millions of fellow Americans. They said it was a Sovietization of the United States, not much different from the updated cries of socialism in recent years. In 1961, Ronald Reagan said that Medicare would lead to socialized medicine, and that doctors, among other dire consequences, would be told in what town they must practice. Questions raised by Reagan's political ancestors in 1935 were still there in 1965, like a rerun of a second-rate movie. Wouldn't people who didn't need additional money get it? Wouldn't people who could pay for their medical expenses get a free ride? Wouldn't doctors be told what to do? Wouldn't the tax taken from my salary soar? And the omnipresent red flag, wouldn't Medicare lead to socialism? Had the incurable conservative reflex succeeded in blocking Social Security, 647,000 Iowans would not be getting retirement checks today. They spend millions of those dollars each month providing jobs and profits for others, as well as better health and security for themselves. That's capitalism at work, and a far cry from the boogeyman socialism. The theoretical commie-red solutions are actually red, white, and blue. Social Security worked from its beginning, providing food on the table, a roof overhead, but in an aging population, health care was needed as well. Harry Truman tried to deal with the problem and failed. John Kennedy was unsuccessful as well. Fortunately, by the time Lyndon Johnson became president, a majority of Americans supported the concept of Medicare. The Senate heard their voices. It was still far from overwhelming, but 17 Republicans joined 55 Democrats to pass the bill. Iowa Senators Burke Hickenlooper and Jack Miller did not. Obamacare was the next step forward to a more universal guarantee of good health care for everyone. Today, as President Joe Biden works to improve and expand our national health programs, there are 63 million Americans under the Social Security umbrella. 60% of them depend on it for half their income. They put $64 billion into our capitalist economy every year. As Biden, by executive order, erases much of Trump's negative legacy, he, like Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, and Obama, must deal with Republican recalcitrance, a chronic disorder uncured in 85 years. There is hope. For a third time, the Supreme Court has kept challenges to Obamacare from crippling it. Seven justices, including Republican appointees, voted to keep it healthy. Bipartisan healing is possible after all these years. Let us hope it gives us the latest debate. Let us hope it lives as the latest debate goes on. Go, Joe. And again, that column is by Norman Sherman, who is a resident of Coralville. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, July 3rd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. Well, first we have the short notices from Fort Atkinson. Steve Sindelar, 77, died Thursday, July 1st. Arrangements are with the Schluter Balick Funeral Home. From Kyoto, Denny Greiner, died Thursday, July 1st. Arrangements are with the Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Kyoto. From Marion, Tim Connolly, 72, died Thursday, July 1st. Arrangements are with the Gulch Funeral Home of Monticello. From Williamsburg, Marie Joy Fry, 85, died Thursday, July 1st. Arrangements are with the Kloster Funeral Home of Marengo. Now we'll move down to the longer notices. From Iowa City, John H. Ewalt, 95, of rural Iowa City, died at his home on Thursday, July 1st. There will be a time of visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 7th, at Gay and Shia Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, with graveside services on Friday, July 9th, at 10 a.m. at the Collins Cemetery in Lockwood, Missouri, where military honors will be provided, period. In lieu of flowers, memorials can be made in John's memory to Hospice of Washington County. From Coralville, the family of Mel Stamer, that's spelled S-T-A-H-M-E-R, invites you to join them as they celebrate his life on Saturday, July 10th. And there's no date of death indicated here. 2 p.m., let's see. The celebration will be at 3 p.m. for graveside service at Oak Hill Cemetery, Highway 6, west of Tiffin. From 4 to 7 p.m., there will be a celebration for memorial there will be a memorial gathering and luncheon for friends and family at Oxford American Legion, 128 East Main Street in Oxford. From Iowa City, Beulah Anna Lortz, that's spelled L-O-R-T-Z, 90, of Iowa City, formerly of Millersburg, passed away peacefully on July 2nd. A celebration of life service will be held at 10 a.m. on Monday, July 5th, at Millersburg, United Methodist Church. Burial will be in the Millersburg Cemetery. Visitation will be on Monday from 9 a.m. until service time at the church. Memorials may be made to the Millersburg Methodist Church or Sarah Risden. For the National... let me take another run at this. For the nation's Powell Funeral Home in North English is caring for Beulah and her family. From Iowa City, Dr. Martin David Sokol, that's spelled S-O-K-O-L-L, 88, of Iowa City, passed away on July 1st at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated Tuesday, July 6th, at 3 p.m. At St. Thomas More Catholic Church, 3000 12th Avenue, Coralville, with Father Chuck Adam officiating. Visitation will be held at the church before Mass at 2 to 3 p.m. Private burial will be held in Ohio at a later date. The funeral mass will be live-streamed for those who cannot attend, and a link can be found on Martin's obituary page at www.lensingfuneral.com. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be directed to Iowa City Hospice or St. Thomas More Catholic Church. From Oxford, Dennis G. Carlson, 72, of Oxford, died Wednesday, June 30th. A time celebrating Dennis's life will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, July 6th, at the Oxford United Methodist Church. For a complete obituary or to share a thought, memory, or condolence with his family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandchia.com. From Iowa City, Margaret Carey Ketterer, that's spelled K-E-T-T-E-R-E-R, 96, of Iowa City, longtime former resident of Monmouth, Illinois, died Wednesday, June 30th, at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County. No public services are being planned. Family will inter both Margaret and her late husband, Dr. John Ketterer, at the Maplewood Cemetery near Boston, New York, where other family members are buried. For a complete obituary or to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit the funeral home website. That's www.gayandchia.com. And now we turn to the sports page of the Gazette for our first story, our first sports story. This is high school baseball, boys high school baseball story. Marion eases past Beckman. Pook Unson pickup pitching wins for 3A's top-ranked team. And the story is by K.J. Pilcher of the Gazette. Owen Puck, that's spelled P-U-K, had a decision to make to start the season. Marion senior all-stater could leave to prepare for his college baseball career at Florida International or remain for his final high school campaign. It turned out to be no dilemma at all. Quote, I've been here since eighth grade year, and we've gone to state three times, Puck said. We have a great culture and a great group of guys. It was an easy decision for me to stay. Puck continues to play a vital role, helping Class 3A top-ranked Marion to a sweep over 2A number 3 Dyersville-Beckman in a WAMAC doubleheader Friday at home. The Indians won the first game, 13-3 in six innings, resuming a contest suspended by rain June 17th, and closed with an 8-3 victory. Players reported at noon for the earlier start with Beckman. This came after Thursday's marathon nightcap of a doubleheader split with 3A number 6 Solon that kept them at the field until almost midnight. Quote, it was tough, Marion coach Steve Fish said. I was kind of expecting a little low energy, and that is how we played. We did what we needed to do. We found ways. Puck has dealt with some injuries, but he has seen the lineup more often. Last week, he served as a designated hitter against Central Point Urbana. He returned to first base against Solon. Puck took the mound for the suspended contest, resuming with two outs in the top of the second. Quote, I'm feeling better, Puck said. I feel good. My body felt good. My control wasn't there, but just trying to work back into it. The 6'5", 185-pound right-hander allowed three runs on just four hits and retired the first six batters he faced. He went the rest of the way, striking out five in four and a third innings. Fish said, quote, pitching, I didn't know what we were going to have for today. Owen has been hurt. He said he would go, period. We had him on a pitch count, but he had an extra 2 weeks. He got a workout out there. He did a good job. Marion at 24-6. let me start that again. Marion at 24-4 carried over a 4-0 lead from the June 17th start. The Indians added two in the second, receiving RBI singles from Miles Davis and Lucas Unson. Davis added an RBI double in the fourth. Two more runs came in the fifth. Gage Frank had an RBI double. The Indians ended the game with a four-run sixth. Jake Tricca had an RBI single in the final at-bat. Davis and Jackson Tejeda led the way with three hits apiece. In the nightcap, Marion pulled away with seven runs in the fourth to eclipse a 2-1 deficit. Tricca and Tejeda opened with consecutive singles. Tejeda added an RBI single later in the inning. Puck had a two-run single, and Caden Frommelt had a run scoring base hit. Puk said, quote, "We're all good hitters, I think. As a team, when we play and execute, we're really solid." Unson earned the win in Game 2. He threw into the sixth and struck out five. Beckman, at 16 and 14, is mired in a slump, losing six straight games. The Blazers suffered a third straight sweep to conference foe falling to Benton Community and Independence this week too. And now we'll turn to a story about girls' high school softball. Lions Hawks split thrilling doubleheader, and this story is by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. The dress rehearsal was a drama-filled draw. The main event, that's 8 days away. Grace McCarty collected four hits and scored the go-ahead run in the top of the 10th inning as Linmar edged Class 5A, 13th-ranked Cedar Rapids Prairie, 5-4, in the first game of a Mississippi Valley Conference softball doubleheader last night at Prairie High School. Quote, "We're here to play," McCarty said of the Lions at 25-9 overall, who have won 15 of their last 17 games. Then it was Prairie's turn to win in dramatic fashion. Riley Souser and Riley Newhard hit back-to-back doubles in the bottom. Hit back-to-back doubles in the bottom of the seventh, and the Hawks at 26-11 claim the nightcap, 5-4. These dead-even teams will play a game for survival on July 10th, a 5A regional semifinal. Linmar coach Lindsay Murray opted to hold back number one pitcher Jordan Beck at 11-2, 0.99 ERA on Friday. McCarty singled each of the first four times she came to the plate. Then she reached on an error in the top of the 10th to start the deciding rally. McCarty said, quote, "I was getting inside pitches, and inside is my pitch. The team needed me. We've been overlooked all season, but we really have great chemistry." After moving to second on Hannah Grellin's sacrifice bunt and to third on a ground out by Sam Gangstad, McCarty beat the throw home on Maddie Wells' infield grounder. Linmar tallied four times in the first inning. Then Prairie rallied late in regulation. The Hawks scored three runs in the seventh on a two-run double by Riley Newhard and a game-tying RBI single by Jensen Jones. In the second game, Prairie scored three early runs and led 3-0 until the seventh, when the Lions erupted for four runs, three on a bases-loaded double by Kaylin Obelton. Snyder led off the bottom of the seventh with a clean single and scored on Souser's two-base hit. Newhard followed by finding the gap to win it. And now I'll turn to the back page of today's Gazette for the Dear Abby column. Woman can't accept ex's new girlfriend. Dear Abby, I've been divorced from my husband of 18 years for 2 years, separated for three, period. I have encouraged my ex to get out and meet new people. It must have been a New Year's resolution of his because I no longer receive random texts to ask how I'm doing or to make casual conversation. When I asked him who she was, he replied, "Nobody." Of course, I know him well, and I knew he wasn't being truthful. He's 50. She's 25. I'm grossed out, mostly because our older daughter is 27. The younger one is 22. I know I should be happy for him, but I'm not. I'm in a happy relationship. Granted, I'm enjoying life and not planning my future, or anything like that. My mind says one thing, my heart says another. Do I need therapy? Are these normal feelings? And this letter is signed Throne in Montana. Dear Throne, it would be abnormal not to have some reaction to the new woman in your ex's life. That he's obscuring the truth from you tells me he may feel guilty about the age difference or worried you will be judgmental. Therapy may help you accept he's now the captain of his fate, so it's no longer necessary for you to help him navigate his life. It would be cheaper to simply let go, allow him to make some mistakes along the way, and focus instead on your own present and future. And that is the Dear Abby column for today. All right. Here's a story on the living page of today's Gazette. This appears under the headline, How to Taste Wine. Enjoying a proper tasting isn't just for master sommeliers. The story is by Elijah Decius of the Gazette. Swisher. It can be easy for the average Joe to be intimidated by master winemakers. I know I was. My first experience ordering high-end wine was at a renowned French restaurant in Washington, D.C., where my friends and I were flashed sneers teeming with contempt by staff after several faux pas during the wine tasting, ordering, and serving process. Being 23 at the time, I drank the sample almost like a shot, seated among the high society of America's capital. So when Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery winemaker Kent Fulker asked about my favorite types of wine, I sheepishly replied, sweet white wines, the same way I would reply to friends asking for my drink or for my drink order at parties where others were enjoying sophisticated reds or microbrew craft beers. I just didn't get what all the fuss was about. Though the art form behind tasting wine is something that has eluded some consumers, it's not something that should intimidate them, says Fulker. One of the first guidelines of wine tasting is that there are no rules, he said, just suggestions. Fulker said, quote, whatever you do that makes it enjoyable for you, that's key. Someone telling you you're doing it wrong, well, they can kiss off. While taste and smell are very individualized, there are a number of ways you can maximize your enjoyment of wine. With exposure and a little thought, you can learn to distinguish the notes in your favorites as well as branch out to appreciate the types you might not typically gravitate toward. When you pour yourself a glass, never fill it to the brim. Give yourself enough room to swirl the wine. That's because swirling the wine is more than just an initiation to set the mood. It's a key to accessing about 80% of wine tasting, which happens through smell. Said Fulker, quote, 80% of wine tasting is through the nose. The olfactory bulb is in the back of your nasal passage on top of your throat. There, all the processing of flavor and aromatics happens. While your tongue can sense acidity, sweetness, and bitterness, it can't pick out the specifics in a wine with much more detail. Since the olfactory bulb is structured in front of the part of the brain that handles memory, people can often be transported to a place in time when they smell something familiar. After a few swishes in the glass, take a deep whiff of the esters, polyphenols, and aromatics released into the head of the glass. Fulker said, quote, when you smell a wine, you're smelling for fruit, herbs, spices, soil composition, that's earthiness, Everything can be in wine. It's not in the wine, but it smells like it. And some elements of wine will mimic the smell of other things. Different notes you smell can come in layers, detected at different points as you inhale or exhale. The colder your wine, the more subdued the smell will be. The ideal pouring temperature for white wine is 45 to 55 degrees, 55 to 65 degrees for reds. Volker said, quote, You can get almost everything from the nose. The tongue is confirmation. Now take a sip. To get the full experience a wine has to offer, the winemaker recommends sucking a little bit of air in while the wine is in your mouth. This aerates the wine a bit, putting all those aromatics inside your mouth. This isn't necessarily something you need to do when drinking casually with friends, but if you want to pay attention to the subtleties, it can help. There's no ideal amount of time to hold a wine in your mouth, though your tongue may notice more of a bite from wines with higher acidity if you let it stick around for more than a few seconds. Volker said, quote, when you swallow, you're not getting all those flavors until you exhale. When you exhale, aromatics in the lungs go to the olfactory bulb to tell you what specific notes are in the wine. That's when you'll start to get the full effects of the wine. For semi-sweet wines, like Atlas, made with Edelweiss and Brianna grapes, you should get hints of mango and papaya, according to the label. All I tasted was fruit. For blends like Harvest Blush, a bestseller at Cedar Ridge, you might be reminded of communion wine or grape juice. I know I was. Volker said, quote, there's a huge amount of psychology that goes into wine tasting. Not everyone tastes the same way, and that's totally cool. Your exposures to food, taste, smells, and the experiences tied to each of those will affect not only what you're able to taste in a wine, but how positively you perceive it. Those differences aside, there is typically some common ground notes for all tasters to detect in each wine. Many categorize themselves as either red or white wine drinkers. But if you're someone who has always enjoyed sweet white varieties, there are ways to cross over. Volker said, quote, people who enjoy sweet wines versus drier wines are true tasters. They're more realistic. There's no judgment on it. No judgment, maybe, but I certainly felt vindicated to hear that red wine is an acquired taste, something that most people don't like on their first try. Before winemaking was a profession, sweet fruit was nutritious and life-sustaining. Let me try that again. Before winemaking was a profession, sweet fruit was nutritious and life-sustaining. Bitter things were typically poisonous or bad. Thus, the human body developed those two flavor profiles through evolution, Volker said. People, quote, people who are drinking dry reds and big bold Cabernets are straight-up liars, he joked. No one ever in history has drank their first bottle of Cabernet and said, this is the most delicious thing ever. Social pressure, as it turns out, plays a big part in why red wine drinkers grow to like bold varieties like Cabernet and Merlot. The same can be said for first experiences with other things, like coffee or cigarettes. Social acceptance or pressure and the positivity of an experience with wine can play a big role in what you gravitate toward. Through repeated exposure to something and a little bit of curiosity, a white wine drinker may be able to appreciate a red. Cedar Ridge Winery's 965 is a good entry level for white wine drinkers because of its composition, according to Volker. It's five grape varieties, fermented and barreled separately. Each bring something different to the table. Quote, I looked at it as a puzzle piece, said Folker, the creator. Frontenac grapes bring a rich aroma. Marquette brings a black raspberry and plum profile. Smaller portions from Petite Pearl bring color and texture from tannins, and Marechal Foch, I'm not sure I pronounced that right, Marechal Foch adds an earthy complexity. Merlot, imported from California, adds structure to the wine that hardy Midwest grapes can't do well. Unlike what you may expect from red wines, 965 won't leave a fuzzy feeling on your teeth and tongue, something that comes from the tannins and is controlled by how long the skin of the grape is left in before being removed. And I will have to end this long and fascinating story right there, because it is time to go. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, July 3rd. I'm your reader, Jim Hill. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. And thank you for listening.